The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
He was a little bit older, and so they couldn't get away with putting him in a work gang, but the idea of a 60-plus-year-old individual who wasn't doing something, it bothered them. But because he was the rabbiner, he was the rabbi, so they couldn't, you know, put him on a work detail. So they found him a job. They got him a Keystone Cop outfit with a ridiculous-looking hat and one of those ridiculous coats, and they put him in front of a warehouse as a watchman. And the Nazis would walk by every day and laugh at this old rabbi who was now a watchman in front of the warehouse. After a couple of months, he became curious. What was in this warehouse that important SS officers were walking in and out of? And he walked inside, and he found that he was guarding one of the repositories for the whole Eastern Lithuanian area for what was going to be the future museum of the extinct Jewish people. The Nazis collected Jewish artifacts, Jewish treasures. We're still trying to get some of them back today, because they were going to have a museum in Berlin of the extinct Jewish race. And more than anything else, you found in this warehouse Jewish books. So what the Nazis had done was to give a tremendous Torah scholar a library. And word spread that Rav Ashri had a library, and people came to him with their questions. And I want to tell you something. We don't value, we don't understand the worth of a question. We are so focused in our day on what the answer is. Sometimes you don't get the answer right away. Sometimes you're supposed to ponder with the question, and the question may stay with you forever. But what question? And he published them in a 5-volume set called Mima Makim, From the Depths. And there's actually a 1-volume book called The Holocaust in Halakha, which is a summary of some of these questions. Magnificent. It's an interesting question. And he actually shares with the reader the stories that lead up to these questions. And he describes a particular morning in the Shacharit service, in the morning prayers, and you have to understand, you know, the first time I read this, I just sort of passed that sentence. And then I had to think about that. There were Jews in the Kovno ghetto who woke up every morning to pray. That's an unbelievable perception. One particular morning, the Chazan, the person who was leading the prayers, stopped in his tracks during the morning blessings. And he literally began to have an argument with God. I would, by the way, suggest that that's the true meaning of prayer. I can't say this. How can you expect me to say this? He had reached the blessing of Shiloh Asani Eved, thanking God for not making me a slave. How can I say this? And the whole congregation is waiting. And he's thinking, and he bangs on the shtender. You want me to lie? I'm not a slave? Every morning I wake up and they beat me. Every night I go to sleep and I don't know if I'm going to wake up in the morning. I have no food to feed my children. I live on a diet which is less than the equivalent of a candy bar every day. You want me to say a lie? I'm not a slave? I can't say it. Very difficult question. And that particular morning, the Chazan didn't say the blessing. And so they came to Rav Ashri, and they asked him this question. And I want you to know, even if I didn't know the answer, that question is an unbelievable question. And Rav Ashri quotes the Avodah Zarah, I believe 16th century, but don't quote me, quotes the Avodah Zarah, who asks this question with regards to Jews in the 16th century who were held in captivity for ransom. Can such a person say, I am not a slave? Listen to this answer. And I don't know that this is an answer, it's a perception, it's a direction. This blessing is not talking about physical slavery. This blessing is talking about something much deeper. What it's saying is that I, as a Jew, can never be a slave, because there is something inside of me that sets me free. I want you to have an image. 2,000 years ago, in the year 70, on the 17th of Tammuz, and the Medrash in Eicha, in Lamentations, rabbinic legend, tells that an angel came down and smote the walls of Jerusalem, and a breach appeared. And if you read Josephus, you won't find any mention of this angel. And if you read the Roman historic accounts of the war, you won't find any mention of this angel. But the rabbis understood that if Jerusalem could fall, it wasn't because the Romans broke the war. It was because we had somehow not succeeded in spiritually fortifying it. You know, if you take a walk from the Jaffa Gate to the Kotel, it'll take you 15 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. It took the Romans 3 weeks to get from the walls of the city to the Temple Mount. 3 weeks from the 17th of Tammuz until the 9th of Av, this night that we commemorate the destruction of the Temple. And you have to wonder, what took them 3 weeks? Until you read Josephus. Josephus, you know, the verdict isn't out on Josephus. Josephus Flavius, whose Hebrew name was Yosef ben Matityahu, was a general of the rebel armies in the north. He fought alongside Yochanan Gush Halav, Elazar ben Yair of Masada fame. And he did the unthinkable. And I tell you that the verdict isn't out on him because the Talmud quotes him. And some seem to have the perception that he did an incredible thing. He surrendered his entire army to Rome. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avot in Ethics of the Father says, Ezehu chacham aro'et hanolad. Who is wise? He who sees that which is to be born. Sometimes you have to know to see the writing on the wall. He does exactly what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai escapes out of the city of Jerusalem because he understands that the jig is up. And Yosef ben Matityahu, who will become Josephus, becomes an advisor on Jewish military affairs to Rome, and he keeps an accounting. And it's an incredible thing to read, the Book of Antiquities, the Book of Wars, because it's an eyewitness account of this period of time. And the situation that he describes in the old city is unbelievable. The fighting. There was a fire that raged through this part of the city. And if you would sit here on a night in the year 70, this area would have just fallen a day or two ago. The Romans, after 2.5 years of siege warfare is a very difficult type of warfare. I want to tell you, as difficult as it may be to be in a situation, in war, where you're fighting, running up a hill, in certain ways it is much, much more difficult to be standing still. I remember in the Intifada, more than one occasion, in the reserves, walking around the corner and finding a riot. I remember one particular instance, a boy, there were about 500, we were in Jabalia, 500 civilians, that's a story in and of itself. And a group of them sort of separated and saw us, and we were waiting for reinforcements. You can't open fire on civilians, thank God, in the Israeli army. And there was one boy, he couldn't have been more than 8 or 9. And he walks a little, a few meters ahead of everybody else, and he starts making lewd gestures at the soldiers, calling them all kinds you can't imagine in Arabic, and some of my men knew Arabic. All sorts of things about their anatomy, and their parents, and their grandparents, and their uncles, and their aunts. And he sees that these men, you know, are getting a little upset, and it's a very difficult thing as an officer. You have to be sure that you have control of your men, that they're not going to do something, and you have to keep saying, Chadal, Af Echad Lo Yoreh, nobody fires. And at one point, this boy walks out a little further, and I'm telling you, he's like an 8-year-old boy. And he had a rock in his hand. And he threw the rock on the ground. And he says, come on! I want you to know, these men were veterans of the Yom Kippur War. They joined the army when for a year it was a good year for milk. They fought in Lebanon. And I could see on their faces how difficult this was. The Roman soldiers sat outside these walls for 2.5 years. And what do you think the Jews did for 2.5 years? Can you imagine getting used to a foreign army outside your walls for 2.5 years? How do you keep Roman legionnaires? You know, Josephus writes that the Roman legionnaires used to take the heads of their victims and put them onto their spears in order to inspire fear in their enemies. I mean, this is the type of an enemy you're talking about. How do you keep them there for 2.5 years in the bitter cold of winter, in the heat of summer? You promise them everything when they get in. You know why it took them 3 weeks to get from the walls to where they burned the temple? Because they raped and burned and looted and pillaged their way through. We, all of us, we just walked here. 2,000 years ago, this was a battle zone. And our ancestors, men and women, the old and the young, children, were put to death and sold into slavery. But I want you to know something. That's not what we're crying over. That's a big mistake people make. They think we're crying because the Romans destroyed the temple, because the Babylonians destroyed the temple. And I want you to know, I never understood the depth of this until I read Josephus. You want to hear an unbelievable thing? The Romans welcomed a deserter with open arms. If someone was labeled a deserter, he was rewarded. The Romans had no problem with Jews leaving the city. That's what they wanted, after all. Every Jew that left the city made it that much easier for them to conquer it. It was the Jews who had the problem. The rebels announced that any Jew who was caught deserting was put to death. And the starvation in the city was so terrible that the Jews were willing to risk their lives under the noses of the rebel army, Jewish soldiers, the Sicarii, to get out. And in the morning, writes Josephus, the ones that were caught were killed, and their bodies were catapulted over the walls. Not for the Romans to see, for the Jews. And their bodies littered the area below the walls, right out there. If we had learned to live together, the Romans could never have taken this city. Talmud tells us that the Jews, through a number of wealthy individuals, succeeded in auguring enough supplies to last them for 18 years. Enough wood for firewood, enough wheat, enough oil. The rebels were afraid that the Jews wouldn't have reason to fight. And they wanted a battle. So they burned the storehouses. Can you imagine? We sit here today 2,000 years later. I want you to know something. I walked through the Jewish quarter today. And I saw an unbelievable sign. It just boggles my mind. On the eve of Tisha B'Av, it's a sign in Hebrew. And it calls out to Jews not to resort to violence. That if one particular community sees another particular community not behaving as it wishes, there shouldn't be violence. And it doesn't matter for the moment who wrote the poster and to whom it's addressed. That's tragic enough. That there should be such a poster in this city on the eve of Tisha B'Av tells me that we have a long way to go. We're not crying just over the building. We're crying over the reason for the destruction of the building. I want you to picture another scene. You know, on Sukkot, we built a sukkah on the roof of Israelite. If you're here on Sukkot, you're all welcome to come join us again. And every evening we had a different event, a musical evening, a shiur, and it was incredible. To have 100 people sitting in a sukkah, singing, and saying the blessing, HaRachamanu Yakim Lanu Et Sukkat David HaNofal. May God return us to the fallen sukkah of the temple. And you're sitting on this roof overlooking the Har HaBayit. And I remember thinking, you know, if you read the Mishnah in Bikurim, if you read the story of how the Jews would come up to Jerusalem on the three festivals, it paints an unbelievable image. Jews would come from all over the country. They would begin from the north. And the villages would come down out of the hill country, and they would be met by other villages. until they gather together into a stream and a torrent of Jews coming up to Jerusalem. And it was arranged apparently in a way that all the Jewish communities would come together. It took apparently 10 days. And each community would reach the next community and would receive hospitality from the next community that would welcome them in and join them. Until gradually this whole sea of Jews would arrive at the feet of the hills of Jerusalem. And the people who lived in Jerusalem would come out to join them. And they would sing and they would dance. And the minstrels would play music. And they would dance up to the Temple Mount. And the priests, the Kohanim, would come out of Har HaBayit, of the Temple Mount, and join the Jews in this magnificent festival of Sukkot. And that's how they would come up to the Temple. Do you know what the Beit HaMikdash symbolizes? There was no sign on the entrance to the Beit HaMikdash. What temple do you belong to? It didn't say when you came into the Beit HaMikdash, which version of the prayer book do you follow? It just said, come in. That's what the temple represents. There was a time when, with all our problems, there was at least a place. At least three times a year where we were together. I want to tell you something. It's a very difficult thing. There's a custom on the 9th of Av, halakha, Jewish law, that you don't say hello. It's actually related to the laws of mourning. When you go into a house of mourning, you don't say hello. If someone is mourning a loved one, you don't walk in and say, here I am. Hello. You just go in and sit down. What you're basically saying is, I'm here for you, not for me. And if you need me, I'm here. But if you're lost in your thoughts, and if you don't need me, then you don't have to need me. And I've been sometimes to a shiva house where I go and I sit for an hour, and no one talks to me, and no one needs me, and I get up, and there's a verse that you say, and I leave. And you know what? You fulfill the mitzvah. And it's a very difficult thing. On the 9th of Av, we don't say hello. And you might find it strange. You walk through the streets here, and maybe you'll recognize somebody from the community here, and you're so used to them coming over to you and saying, hey, how you doing? And tonight they won't. They'll just look at you and nod their heads. And I want you to know that's very difficult. I mean, if I could think of one day in the year when we should learn to say hello, it would be Tisha B'Av. I wonder if this isn't the one day of the year where we're supposed to understand that that's the reason that we're still sitting here on the floor. It shouldn't feel good not to say hello. It should bother us not to say hello. It should feel uncomfortable not to say hello. It's the whole idea. And you sit on the floor, on the ground. I want to tell you my perception. I shared this with a few people this week on the tour. You know, when Moshe first meets God, the whole beginning of Moses' life, there's no mention of God. It's unbelievable. He's born, and he begins his life only with women, his mother, his sister, the daughter of Pharaoh, and then he goes out into the world and he meets men, and he sees an Egyptian and a Jew fighting, and then he sees two Jews fighting, and this, of course, sends him into exile. And that's a clearly understood message. And then he goes to the desert, then he goes to Midian, and he meets his wife and his father-in-law, and he becomes a shepherd. It takes until he's 80 years old, out in the desert sun, to find God. And he finds God, by the way, not in a mountain, he finds him in a burning bush. And he says, Asura nava er etamare agadol hazeh. I have to see this. Because if you want to find the relationship with Hashem, you have to find it. It's not going to come get you. Too many of us are waiting for God to come get us. And Moses goes up to the mountain. And you know what the first line that God says to Moshe is? Shal na na'alecha me'al ragla. Take your shoes off. Could you think of a stranger thing for God to say? This is God's introduction to Moshe. And I want to tell you something. We sit on Tisha B'Av on the floor, and we wear shoes that are not leather. And the Talmud says, you know, we've kind of lost this custom. We wear our Nike New Balance Air Pump shoes. That's not the original idea of the Talmud. The original idea of the Talmud in Tractate of Yoma that talks about Yom Kippur describes the Talmudic authorities wrapping their feet in rags so that they could feel the earth beneath the feet. I want to tell you what I think that story means. I think God is telling Moshe Rabbeinu, you're going to climb so high up the mountain, you're going to reach a level of spirituality that no human being has ever reached. Don't forget the ground beneath your feet. Don't forget that the goal, the purpose of climbing that mountain is to come back down to earth. I want to tell you one of the things that frightens me most. So many Jews, so many of us are looking for so much spirituality. And I want you to know that's an incredible thing. To discover who I am. To discover meaning in my life. And it's not for me to tell a person how to do it. But I found it in Torah, no doubt about it. And it's an incredibly spiritual experience. I went to a yeshiva with 400 guys. Today there are 800 there. And you sit in this yeshiva on Yom Kippur. It's like a sea. It's unbelievable. Everybody sings the prayers. It's like a roar. And you sit there at night at 1 in the morning and there's 100 guys sitting and learning Torah. It's incredible. And you get so deep and so focused. I remember there were periods I was in yeshiva. I didn't leave yeshiva for a couple of months. I was there during the week and I was there for Shabbat. I didn't need anything out of yeshiva. And it's an incredible experience. And you walk out of that experience and you all of a sudden can't deal with the outside world almost. That's what God is telling Moshe. That's not where it's supposed to be. If you're in your Beit Midrash and you're in your house of study and you forget the ground, then something's wrong. Because the purpose of Torah is not so that it stays in the Beit Midrash in the house of study. The purpose of Torah, of the ethical value of Torah, of the beauty of Torah, is to bring it out to the ground. To bring it back to earth. If I can learn Torah in the old city of Yerushalayim, if I can bring Torah to Dizengoff Street, that's a whole different level. And I wonder if that isn't why we sit on the ground on Tisha B'Av. Because that's how we got here. We were climbing so high. The level of scholarship at the end of the Second Temple, the period of the Mishnah, was unparalleled. But they lost the Beit HaMikdash. And I want to tell you one more thing. I was talking before with the students at Israelite. It's a very, very difficult thing to focus on the Beit HaMikdash, on the Temple. It's a very difficult thing to focus on 2,000 years of Jewish history. You know, from the year 1649 to 1654, during those five terrible, black, dark years in Jewish history, a man by the name of Bogdan Khmelnytsky swept across the eastern steppes of the Ukraine, eastern Russia. There are different estimates as to how many Jews were killed during the Khmelnytsky massacres. Perhaps as many as 300,000, some say as many as 1.2 million. This was a period before machine guns, before carbon monoxide bans, before gas tubes. They did it with their hands. You can't even begin to imagine the cruelty. There's a sefer, there's a book that was written by a great Torah scholar who survived one such massacre in one such village. It's called Gates al Mavet, the Valley of the Shadow of Death, from the famous Psalm of King David. And he describes what happened to his village. They came in the middle of the night. And the reason he was saved was because he awoke and he heard thunder in the distance. But it was summertime. And he got out of bed and he tried to wake his family to no avail. And he ran outside. It was the thunder of horses. The Cossacks had arrived. And they dragged the Jews out of their homes in the middle of the night. And they took them down to the river by the village. And the river ran red with their blood. He described seeing what happened to his own mother. How she was tied to four trees. And a Cossack rode through. We can't even begin to imagine. How do you deal with it? I want to tell you something. In a moment we're going to read Echa, the Lamentations. I want to give you one thing to think about. I don't know if we can focus and all that's happened in Jewish history. Can't do that, it gets lost. I wonder if maybe we weren't meant to just focus on one piece of it. And if you can't appreciate the whole building, at least we can focus on one story, on one perception. Because each human being is a Beit HaMikdash, is a temple. And therefore, each piece of pain is the destruction of a temple. I want to tell you a quick story about one of the temples in my life that was destroyed. And I think of him all the time. I think of him on Yom HaZikaron, on Memorial Day, when I go to his grave. And I think of him on Tisha B'Av, when I appreciate that the reason that he was lost was because of this day. In 1984, I was in officer's course. And we were on our way down to the desert, to Shizafan. And on the one hand, we were in a very good mood. Because we had just gotten through a stage of officer's course called Julis, which was really sort of tank school training. And they take the things that you had learned as a driver and later as a sergeant, and you spend 3 weeks learning every nut and bolt of the tank. How the laser worked, and how the gunnery system worked, and how the engine worked, and how to fix the treads. You know, there's no little crew that runs along with you in battle like in the American Army. You have to do it yourself. And at the end of these 3 weeks, there's a 2.5-day test, non-stop, all day and night. Maneuvers, recognizing enemy, warfare. Blue smoke means oil burning, white smoke means gas problem, everything you can imagine. How do you fix your laser gun sight? And 20% of the course usually falls out at the end of these 2.5 days. And so those of us who have made it through to this stage were in a very good mood. And we stopped off in Be'er Sheva to pick up a few guys who were joining us on our way back down to base. And on the one hand, like I said, we were in a good mood. On the other hand, it was a little depressing, because this particular 3 weeks had been sort of in civilized country, near Ashkelon, not far from the beach, and we'd gotten the occasional time off. And now we were going back down to the desert, to Shizafon. It's about an hour north of Eilat, in the heat. And it was just after Purim. It was the 19th of Adar, Tafshin Mem Dal, Tashmad, for me the year of destruction. And Avi Elimelech, a good friend of mine who was with me in the army, came over to me and said, "Did you hear the news?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, I heard the name, it's Kmozhitz, on the radio." And I said, "Nah, it can't be." And he said, "Well, maybe it is, it's in Yerushalayim." So we went over to our commander, and I had the sense that he was less imagining than it really could be, and more thinking this was a great excuse to get a day off. Can we go to the funeral? Not really thinking it was serious, because I couldn't imagine that I wouldn't have heard. They would have let us know. And the Ganan, name for the officer who runs officers, is called the Ganan, which means the nursery teacher. And he said, "Listen, we can only spare one of you, because you know for maneuvers you need a certain number of guys on the tanks." So I said to Avi, "You go." I only knew Danny from Gush, from Yeshiva. He'd known Danny through high school. And to be honest, I didn't think it was a serious thing. And for me, especially since my Hebrew wasn't yet up to par, missing a whole day or two of officer's course was not a simple thing. I didn't want to have to make it up. So we got back on the bus, and when I got to Mitzvah Rimon, I bought a paper. When I bought the paper, I saw it wasn't just Danny Mozhitz, but Dudi Kohn. And the two of them, Dudi Kohn and Danny Mozhitz, had been on a patrol in Lebanon. And you got to understand who Danny Mozhitz was. When I came to Yeshiva in 1981, I didn't know much Hebrew. And I decided that I was going to go into the army, but I figured I'd wait a year. And after a year, I realized I wasn't ready, I was going to wait another year. But I figured since I was going into the Hesder unit, boys who did Yeshiva and did the army, that I wanted to get to know the Israelis that I was going in with, even though they were a year younger than me. I didn't know any of them, and I didn't really know how to get to know them. And I decided that at the end of each day, at dinner, I would sit with the Israeli table. You know how it is. We sit with whom we know. The Americans all sat at American tables. The Israelis all sat at Israeli tables. And that's fine. And so I plunked myself with a group of Israelis. So in the first 2 months, my conversation with them consisted of, "Please pass the sugar, and may I have some bread?" And they would make an occasional joke, and they would all laugh, and I wouldn't know what they were talking about. After about 2 months, this boy, tall, over 6 feet, blonde hair, blue eyes, with a really kind face, incredibly intelligent, clearly one of the leaders of the pack, sharp. Turns to me and he says, Tagidli, Mantel Sipo, what are you doing here? I thought, okay, this is the apex. This is real Israeli. What are you doing here? So I said, well, I'm going into the army at the end of the year, and I don't know anything. And I thought, if I said it, I'd get to know you. And I could sense that his puzzlement wasn't rude. He just couldn't imagine why an American would want to sit with him. From that day on, he took me under his wing. Every birthday party, every teal, every wedding, every time the guys would get together at night in one of the rooms, he would make sure I was there. He made it his personal mission to take me around and introduce me to all the guys. He made it his mission to teach me Hebrew. He said to me, you know, I want to have a chavuta with you. Let's learn together. So I said, okay, you know, when are we going to learn? So he said, well, 1:30. Now in Gush, lunch ends at 1. Lunch starts at 1. Usually people sit at lunch till 1:30, quarter to 2. And then there's a break. So I figured, okay, to learn with him, I'll give up my break. So I came that afternoon at 1:30. He wasn't there. 2 o'clock, 2:30, he wasn't there. So I went over to him after Mincha at 3:15, 3:30. I said, where were you? He said, what are you talking about? I said, we said 1:30. He looked at me and he said, what do you mean? 1:30, not after lunch, 1:30 tonight. 1:30 in the morning. And it was obvious to him. Why would a Jew want to go to bed in yeshiva? And so we would sit every night at 1:30 in the morning, we had a chavruta. With my eyes at toothpicks. Unbelievable boy. I wanted desperately to be with him in the army, because I had glasses. They didn't take me in infantry. I fought. I stayed an extra day. In the end, we were in different units. I was in the army corps. He was in infantry. After our first stint, I had a 6-month break to learn in yeshiva before I left Hezder and went to officers' corps. And we hit it off again. And we learned again. And one day, I was walking by the phones. And I see Danny standing by the phone. This is about 2 months into it. And he's talking in perfect English. And I did a double take with an English accent. And it was obvious he was talking to a girl, and he was very personal about his relationships with girls, so I didn't bug him about it. And he sees me standing there, and my mouth drops open. And I wait till he gets off the phone, and he comes over with a smile, a little twinkle, and I said, you speak English? And he says to me, yeah, of course I speak English. I was born in England. And I said to him, why did you never speak to me in English? And he says to me, because if I would have spoken to you in English, you wouldn't have learned Hebrew. And I'm sitting on a bus with a newspaper in my hands, and there's Danny Moshitz's face. And I want you to know, I invited his parents to my wedding. And they couldn't stay. They stayed for the chuppah they had to leave. And I realized then what it is. Because for us, it's the funeral. But for them, it's forever. And they weren't seeing me at my wedding. They were seeing Danny. Who is the girl that Danny was meant to marry and never met? Who are the children who were never born? Who are the grandchildren that they will never bounce on their knees? And it hits you all of a sudden in your gut. You'll never hear his smile again. And you'll never be able to learn with him again. And all the Torah that he had to give the Jewish people is lost forever. And that's one Beit HaMikdash. That's one temple. And it's destroyed. Go to Har Herzl and you will see modern Abraham and Sarah's crying over their lost temples. And that's why we sit here on this night. Because I want you to know, before we learn to build a temple, we have to learn to build with each other. And all the problems in the Jewish people, all of them, none are compared to the fact that we have not yet learned to sit together. That's what Tisha B'Av means. And that's what this night represents. We're going to sit now and read the Echa. And in between the chapters, maybe I'll mention a brief word. We don't have enough Echas, we realize, for the people who are here. So if you have one, or you can share one, wonderful. If you can't, then you can follow the words. I want you to know that this tune, the tune of lamentation, is 2,000 years old. This book of Echa was written by Jeremiah the prophet 2,000 years ago. And it represents the pain of this night. For so many years, Jews lived underground. We don't appreciate that. There's an unbelievable Talmudic discussion in Shabbat. The Talmud says that we're not supposed to wear, I mentioned this on the tour this week, we're not supposed to wear na'alayim mesumarot, havdil boots. And it's very strange, they make a certain noise on Shabbat, it's not nice. And the Tosfot there says an unbelievable thing. It says, because if you wear a hobnail boot, it sounds like the boot of a Roman legionnaire. And if you're walking over a cave, unbeknownst to you, and there are Jews in that cave on Shabbat, you'll send them into a panic. They won't light a torch because it's Shabbat, and you'll cause them anguish on Shabbat. It was so common that Jews lived in caves that the halakha takes this into account in terms of what kind of boots we wear. Can you imagine? I once went to San Francisco and I visited Alcatraz. I don't know if any of you ever went to Alcatraz. You go on this tour, and as part of the tour, they put you in a cell. And they locked the doors. And the guy that I was with, I guess, was a little bit of a sadist. And he walked off. He didn't give the, I guess, what he was supposed to say, you know, sort of like, we'll be back, this is for 2 minutes, see what it feels. He just locked us in the cells. Said, see what it feels like, and walked off. And there were like three or four of us in the cell. And, you know, everybody was in different cells. And we kind of looked at each other sort of like, this is not good. And I want you to know, up here, I knew. I mean, it was obvious to me that in a moment, you know, they would open the doors. And I want you to know it was a scary experience. Not for claustrophobics. And you're in this cell, and it's completely dark for 2-3 minutes. And you imagine what it must be like to be locked up there in Alcatraz. But I want you to know that's nothing compared to what our people suffered after the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Can you imagine? You know, I live in Ephrat, and I love the old city of Jerusalem. I couldn't live here. It has a power, a spiritual energy. I don't know that I could live here. And one of the things I love about living in Ephrat is that in front of my home, there's a little street. It's called the Rehov Olandi. It's not a street for cars. It's like an inner street. And my children go out there in the warm weather and they play with all the other children on the block. And it's incredible. And in the winter, I feel it missing because they don't get to play outside. Can you imagine what it must have been like to bring your children up in a cave? To know that if the Romans find you, they'll set you on fire and throw fire in through the entrance. Can you imagine what it must have been like to have a child who for 4, 5, 6, 7 years never saw the light of day? And that's how our people live. And I want to tell you an unbelievable thing. In that cave, on the floor, on the 9th of Av, they read Eicha. It's because of them that we're sitting here reading Eicha today. You'll see to your left a lower area, a park. It's called Ganat Kuma. Literally the park of the revival of the Jewish people. And if you go there on a summer evening after Tisha B'Av, probably by the end of this week, if you go there every night, chances are you'll see a wedding. And wedding parties dance there underneath the walls of Yerushalayim. When they were doing the archaeological digs there, they found a very strange thing. Further down along the wall towards the east, they found some iron rings in the wall. And they couldn't figure out what they were. At first they thought they were rings used to tie up animals, but the height wasn't quite right. They finally figured out through Josephus. You know, we look at the 9th of Av as a spiritual disaster. Josephus is quite cold about it. And he mentions that it was also an economic disaster. Because there were many Roman citizens who were wealthy because of the slave trade. And overnight, 100,000 Jewish slaves flooded the market. And men who were wealthy became poor overnight. What a perception. You know what those rings were? Those rings were used to chain our ancestors in an open air market as they were sold into slavery alongside the headquarters of the Roman 10th Legion. You know, if you walk out here, you'll see a museum called the Burnt House. And they discovered the bottom floor of a house completely intact from the period of the Second Temple of Baicheng. And when they carbon dated the walls, they realized that this house had been burned in the great fire that raged here in the year 70 when the temple was destroyed. They found food in this house. A couple of dates, a fig, preserved, dried, which meant that this was a wealthy family because of the starvation. They found the seal of the Katros family. This was a family of priests mentioned in the Mishnah. They know that there were at least five Jews living in this home. They found a spearhead embedded in what was left of a part of the door, and so they ascertained that the legionnaires burst into this home, perhaps one evening during dinner. But no one knows what happened to this family. Were they killed on the spot? Or were they dragged off in tears to that slave market and sold into slavery? How many painful goodbyes? How many families ripped apart on that slave market? How many centuries of Jewish tragedy? Mothers ripped from children, brothers separated. And I want you to know, from that slave market to the platforms of Auschwitz, the Jews have suffered this painful divide. And I want you to know more than anything else, Tisha B'Av is a cry out to Hashem. It's time! It's enough! We have to do our bit in order that Hashem listens to this. He came here this night for nothing else but this story. It's worth your coming. Anybody who's ever met me and spent time with me must have heard this story, because this had a powerful effect on me. But if you've heard this story and you haven't told it to anyone yet, that's also good enough reason to hear. One of the most powerful Sfarim books that I ever learned is called the Esh Kodesh, Holy Fire. I want to tell you who wrote this sefer and what it means. Hieronymus Kalman was a tremendous, tremendous Torah scholar. And I want you to know, I first heard this story from Shlomo Kalman. I never understood the stories, really, until I learned the sefer. It's a very difficult sefer. Hieronymus Kalman was a tremendous Torah scholar. He became a dayan when he was 19 years old. And you have to understand, in the traditional system, rabbinic ordination, smicha, is not simple. I know that here in Israel, the chief rabbinate, which is the smicha that I did, very difficult test. And it takes 3, 4, 5 years to do these tests. And at least in the system I was with, you can't even begin to study for these tests until you've studied Torah and yeshiva for at least 5 years. And that's just regular rabbinical ordination. Dayanut, to be a judge, takes years and years. The guys, the few who I know, who actually made the effort and succeeded, it took them 10, 12 years. If you have to study parts of two sections of the Code of Jewish Law, of the Shulchan Aruch, for rabbinic ordination, you have to study all four and know them backwards and forwards to be a dayan. Hieronymus Kalman became a dayan by the time he was 19 years old. That was unheard of. And he was appointed to the Beit Din, to the court of Pizet. And he was very charismatic. And Hasidim flocked him. And the way Shlomo Kalbach tells it, in those days, so a child would learn Aleph Beis in the Cheder, right? The children would go to Cheder, and they would learn Aleph Beis. And at a certain age, when they'd learned enough, 12, 13, 14, and then they would go off to Yeshiva. And they would go to Yeshiva. And they would find the place that was right for them, maybe a Rebbe that they could relate to, and they would become Hasidim of that Rebbe. As Hieronymus Kalman realized at a certain point, why shouldn't there be a Rebbe for the 7-year-old? All these 6 and 7-year-olds had no Rebbe. So he did something that I have never heard of a Hasidic Rebbe doing. He dumped his students, all of them. He told all the adults who loved him so much to go find another Rebbe. And he opened up a Talmud Torah school for the 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 year olds. Now, as luck would have it, he did this just before World War I. You know, we focus on the Holocaust of World War II. We don't realize sometimes what a tremendous tragedy for the Jewish people World War I. Because the Jews are always caught in the middle, and this was no exception. And as the German and the Allied armies attacked each other across the plains, the Jews were always in the way. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were killed in World War I. And tens of thousands of Jewish orphans wandered across Europe. And many of them found their way to Piazetta. And Hieronymus Kalman took in every Jewish orphan who came. They say that by the end of World War I in 1920, there were as many as 7,000 Jewish children in Piazetta. They say you never saw a Friday night Lechad Odi unless you saw the Piazetzner Rebbe dancing with its children. The Piazetzner Rebbe, World War II, with all of his children, ended up in the Warsaw Ghetto. And you can imagine that a man such as the Piazetzner in the Warsaw Ghetto was a tremendous source of inspiration. I want to tell you, I will never pray the evening service at a festival the same way again since I've heard this story. The story they tell about the Piazetzner Rebbe, that he sent a flyer around the Warsaw Ghetto, that he had found a basement, a cellar, that could hold 5,000 people. And he invited the Jewish people of Warsaw, of the ghetto, to come and dance the traditional circles of dancing for Simchat Torah, for the festival where we celebrate the completion of reading of the Torah and the beginning again of the study of Torah. And we dance with the Polish girls. Can you imagine? The dance in the ghetto. Can you imagine an attempt to celebrate the holiday of joy of Torah in the ghetto? And everybody said to everybody else, nobody will show. But they all found the cellar. That night of Simchas Torah, 20,000 Jews crammed into that cellar. And you have to understand something. Any public display of worship was a crime punishable by death. So this is an unbelievable moment. And people debated whether the PSS and the Rebbe would show up. Would he come? He had just lost his daughter that week. He had lost his son in law. And he had lost his wife. All the week of Chol HaMoed of Sukkot. So he was a mourner. Would he come? 5 minutes went by, 10 minutes went by, 20 minutes went by. And then from the far end of the basement, they parted like a sea. And the Piazetzner Rebbe was splendid in his white holiday clothes. Strode into the room. And I can only tell you the way Rav Shlomo Kalba tells the story. A hush fell over the crowd. Can you imagine? I mean, can you imagine what a moment? 20,000 Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto on Simchas Torah night. And the Piazetzner Rebbe calls out the beginning of the evening service. My and the meaning of that verse that we say at the beginning of the night, bless God who is blessed. I want you to know, it makes no sense. How do you bless God who is blessed? In fact, the whole concept of a blessing makes no sense. Why am I blessing God? And this verse, Baruch Hu Et Hashem HaMivarach, who is blessed, implies the question. God's already blessed. 20,000 Jews in Warsaw Ghetto. And it must have been like a roar of a sea. The response is to bless God who is blessed forever. Forever! Because I don't bless God for God. I bless God for me. For us. And it's interesting that when I respond, I don't say, Avarech et Hashem, I will bless God. Everybody in the room is telling everybody else to make a blessing. But what's the concept of a blessing? The concept of a blessing is appreciating where I am. What I have. What I've been given. a potential variant. If 20,000 Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto can appreciate the gift of a moment in the ghetto in World War II on Simchas Torah night, then that's why Jews wake up in the morning and say, God has not made me a slave. Because what is it to be free? That's freedom. And what we long for is not physical. It's something much, much deeper. You look around the world today. You look around this country. And so many Jews, so many people are enslaved by so many things. And that has to cause us pain. And that's what we're waiting for on this night. After the war, a little Polish boy who's probably got a seat up where somewhere in heaven because of this, not a Jew, was digging, playing in the Warsaw Ghetto. Sorry. And he found a manuscript. And it looked like it might be worth something. So he took it to a soldier, an African-American, in the U.S. 8th Army. And this black soldier for sure is also in heaven. Because he realized that it must have been Jewish from the Warsaw Ghetto. And he took it, I believe, to Rav Schechter, the chaplain of the U.S. 8th Army, who read it and immediately understood what it was. The Piazetzner Rebbe gave weekly discourses in the portion of the week. And he wrote some of them down. And he rolled them up in a manuscript. And he buried them. And after the war, they were found. And I want you to know there's an unbelievable letter in the introduction to this manuscript. And it says, whoever you are, I don't know if you're reading this. I've probably gone to the world of truth. And I don't know if there are any Jews left in Warsaw. And I don't know if there are any Jews left in Poland. I don't know if there are any Jews left in Europe. I don't know if there are any Jews left anywhere in the world. But I know that there must be Jews left in Palestine. If you will send this manuscript to Palestine, for a certain Rav Shapira, who lives in the village of Tel Aviv near Yafo, and I will pray for you and your family. From heaven. He doesn't stop there. He says, and you who are reading this hopefully published book, if you will learn the Torah from this book, I will go before the chair of mercy of God Himself to pray for you and your family forever. Now I'm standing in the Sfarim store, and I'm reading this introduction to this book. And you can imagine I decided I'm going to learn this book. And I want to tell you one thought of Torah from this book. And every time I think of the Eish Kodesh, this is the thought that stands with me. There's an unbelievable verse, says the Eish Kodesh, Holy Fire, which is the name it was published on. Esai Nail Harim, I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Me'ayin yavoz. From whence comes my salvation? Ezri me'im Hashem, oseh shamayim v'aretz. My salvation comes from God, the creator of the heaven and the earth. The Eish Kodesh, the Piazetzner, asks a very good question. He says, the verse doesn't make sense. Why am I asking, or why am I saying, that my salvation comes from Hashem, from God, the creator of heaven and earth? I know who God is. And if I'm already accepting that salvation comes from God, then I know that God created the heaven and the earth. So the verse makes no sense. And the Eish Kodesh gives an answer. The Eish Kodesh says, sometimes you find yourself in a situation, it's very difficult. And you know what you need to do to get out of that situation, and you hope, you pray, you struggle to succeed in that venture. You're sick, and you have to get to a hospital, and you need a certain type of medicine, but you know if you get that medicine, it'll work out. And so you pray that you should make it to the hospital. And you pray that the medicine should be there, and you pray that the operation should be a success. You're driving through traffic, and you go through a traffic light. And you turn left and you see there's a truck coming at you. And you pray that his brakes will work, that your brakes will work, that you'll make it. Sometimes, says the Piers Etzner, you're in a situation and you can't imagine how you're going to get out of it. You're driving a car and you take a wrong turn and you go off Mount Everest. And you're flying down 5 miles. What do you pray for? Wings? And who is writing this? Eponymous Colin in the Warsaw Ghetto in 1942. Sometimes you're in a situation and you can't imagine how you're going to get out of it. Says Eponymous Kalman, remember that this situation and everything in this situation, the heavens and the earth and Germany and Poland, they were all created by Hashem. So if there's a way out of it and you can't find it, Hashem will find it. Don't give up. And you may not understand it, but it's there. How many Jews had to struggle with that verse for the last 2,000 years? How many Jews trembling in their villages when the Crusaders roared through their villages? How many Jews walking how many miles? How many Jews lighting candles in basements in Spain? How many Jews lived in Russia, in Morocco, in Syria, for 2,000 years? And here we sit. Do we really know what this means? I want you to know. What an incredible moment that a Jew has reached the stage that on the 9th of Av can wonder whether we have to fast. We dreamed for 2,000 years of being in such a situation. You'll take a walk outside now. Walk up on Israelite's roof. And look down at the Kotel. It's unbelievable. 1948. On a warm spring night in May, 600,000 people took to the streets in dancing and song. Because a state had been declared. And I want you to know, the world thought they were absolutely mad. 7 Arab armies had declared that they were going to push them into the sea. They were outnumbered in some places 15 to 1. The Jews in the Old City. There were 1,600 Jews living in the Old City. 200 fighters. 2 weeks later, they would surrender with just 60 bullets left, surrounded by 30,000 Arabs. And you read Forever My Jerusalem, written by a woman who lived here in the Old City. They danced on that night. Madness! Mad like a fox. The same foxes that wandered across the Temple Mount, written in the Book of Eight. For 2,600 years, after Jeremiah cried of the Temple, you have come home. I want you to know something. We are not home yet. You go up on the Temple Mount. Tomorrow afternoon, you'll see kids playing soccer up there. And that's not a political statement. That's not the issue for you. It should cause me pain. And there are so many Jewish temples that need to be rebuilt in this world. And you can find them all over. Maybe some of them are sitting here in this room. Of sorts. And that's our challenge. And that's what Tisha B'Av has to mean. And if you can walk through this city on this night and not feel the pain. Millions of Jews all over the world. Then it means that you're still looking for something in this world. And that's what Tisha B'Av is. May it be Hashem's will that this should be the last year that we have to fast on the 9th of Av. And I invite you here, God willing, we should all learn to care about each other, to dance in this courtyard next year.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.